Hey, everybody, the Grill Sergeant John Largent. I want to thank you so much for downloading this week's episode of Tailgate Radio. And I want to thank our sponsors who help keep the lights on and make sure that this virtual tailgate party keeps rocking and rolling all year long. Take a few minutes, go to our website at tailgateradio.com and click on one of our sponsor links. You won't be disappointed, and it doesn't cost a penny to look. Again, thank you for all your support of Tailgate Radio, making us one of the most successful podcasts in the sports and outdoor category. Enjoy this week's episode.
From coast to coast and border to border, it's Tailgate Radio. Here's your host, the Grill Sergeant, John Legend.
Up in the parking lot, got the beer on ice, and the grill is hot. On your walk, kids said, baby, ready or not, we're gonna get some. We got ribs and things, chicken and baked beans, plates of styrofoam, we came to get it on. Daylight and dark, whenever we all park, just get some.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Tailgate Radio. I'm the Grill Sergeant John Largent. Thank you so much for downloading this week's episode. And we got a great show for you this week. You know, every now and then we like to step into the world of Hollywood and celebrities and glitz and glamour and all that. So this week we're speaking to a guy that was one of the stars of Big Time Rush on Nickelodeon. He's done numerous commercials. He's worked with Comedy Central as a producer and writer, with most notably with Jeffrey Ross. He's a stand-up comic and just is living the life in Southern California as a celebrity and actor. We've got Mr. Stephen Kramer Glickman going to join us this week. Funny guy, and we just turn on the microphones and just start talking, and I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. Just a very interesting guy, and an opportunity, just a peek to understand what that business is all about, and then just get the humorous perspective from somebody that is out there working it every day. So we've got Stephen Kramer Glickman in this week. We've also got our regular segment, You've Got to Be Freaking Kidding Me, or Are You Freaking Kidding Me? I don't know. I think it's Are You Freaking Kidding Me? Anyway, we've got the sports mouth of the South, Jason Fairchild, with his segment this week. Can't wait to hear his opinion, and can't wait to hear your backlash from his opinion as you guys continue to go off on his take on things. And some of you really like what he says, and some of you don't like what he says, and that's okay too, because he's a very opinionated guy, and that's why we have him on the show. We want to stir up a little interest, and he certainly is very good at that. So we've got a fantastic show for you, and before we go into our first break and get ready to have Stephen in, we want to just thank you guys again, and I know I thank you every week, but it's just an amazing experience to have so many people listening and following the show every week. You know, Tailgate Radio and Game Day Media Productions, by the way, which is the parent company of our show. You know, we're all based here in San Antonio, Texas, and our shows are based out of everywhere. We have more than this show. We have Track Smack with Dawn Murphy. She is a NASCAR and racing veteran broadcaster and journalist, and she brings her very unique style and wit and charm to her show every week, and she is a great host of that show. And if you're a motorhead, a gearhead, and you like NASCAR or Indy, or I think they even talk Formula One every now and then, and NHRA, you want to listen to Track Smack with Dawn Murphy, and you can catch her on all the places you can catch Tailgate Radio, like iTunes and Stitcher Radio and the TuneIn app for your smartphone. Over in Europe and Australia, New Zealand, you can catch us on Audio Boom. Thank you to all the folks that are tuning in overseas to the show. We really appreciate that, and we can't wait to have some of you guys on as guests of our show so we get a global perspective on tailgating, because not everybody calls it tailgating, but they still partake in tailgating, and so it'll be fun to explore how, I really want to delve into the Premier League and find out, or the Liga de Mexicana, and learn how the cultures. You know, they do a lot of the tailgating after games, and the big post-celebration party. So there's just a whole lot we can do with that, and we certainly are extending our reach by utilizing platforms like Audio Boom. Also, you can listen to us on your Roku and your Apple TV, and so you can catch us there if you're in the house and cooking and you don't have access to your smartphone, but you've got one of those devices. You can tune us in there, and you can listen to us anytime. Also want to thank our sponsors. We have some great sponsors. You can go to our website at tailgateradio.com and check out our great sponsors. And we're going to be having some upcoming giveaways for the 4th of July. We'll have more information on that next week. So you'll want to make sure that you tune in there with an opportunity to get some cool swag and some tasty swag at that, hopefully. We'll have more details on that next week for you and your family or your get-together for the 4th of July. So when we come back from the break, we're going to have Stephen Kramer Glickman, and he's going to talk to us all about the life and times of a Hollywood celebrity. We'll be back with more Tailgate Radio right after this.
All right, Tailgate Nation, I want to talk to you right now about the Tailgater Portable Satellite Antenna. It is a revolution in entertainment. Now, let me tell you what I mean. From the stadium to the shore to the great outdoors, the Tailgater gives you access to HD dish programming, including all those college games and NFL games you want to watch when you're out in the parking lot. And it'll do it no matter where you want to watch it. Now, listen to this. It has a fast and simple plug-in and push-button setup. Nothing is more convenient than that, especially when you're getting everything else set up out in the parking lot for game day. It has full HD and SD dish programming. It automatically acquires that satellite signal, and it's lightweight and portable. It weighs under 10 pounds. It has a durable and weather-resistant casing, so whether you're tailgating in the deserts of Arizona or up in the Northeast where there's tons of snow falling down later in the year, you're covered. And listen to this, folks. It's a pay-as-you-go or add-to-your-existing dish account with no startup or cancellation fees. Let me repeat that. It's a pay-as-you-go or you can add to your existing dish account with no startup or no cancellation fees. Now, here's some really cool stuff, too. The Tailgater Portable Satellite Antenna was the winner of an International Consumer Electronics Show Innovations Award for Design. It was created by King in collaboration with Dish, and it's the lowest-cost antenna of its type on the market. Now, here's some really cool news. It has awesome customer satisfaction, with over 90% of the owners saying they would recommend it to a friend. So never miss another game and tailgate like a pro. Visit kingcontrols.com to find a retailer near you or go to getyourtailgater.com and order it online. That's kingcontrols.com or getyourtailgater.com.
And welcome back to Tailgate Radio. I am so excited to have our guest on this week. He has been on television numerous times, probably most well known as Gustavo on Nickelodeon's Big Time Rush, but I've seen him on like a Jeffrey Ross special. He's on TV. He's done Broadway. He's got his own clothing line. This guy does a little bit of everything. Let's bring in to Tailgate Radio, our virtual tailgate party, Mr. Stephen Kramer Glickman. Welcome in.
Woohoo! Yeah, let's get this tailgate on.
Yeah, so I want to start off by talking about, I did some extensive research on you and your career. Found out you were born in London, Ontario, and
London, Ontario, Canada. It's one of those things when you tell somebody, they get progressively more bored. The more you tell them where you're from, they're like, "Where are you from?" You're like, "London." They're like, "Oh wow." And you're like, "Ontario." And they're like, "Huh?" And you're like, "Canada." And they're like, "Bored. So bored."
Oh man. Really, it was that's hilarious. You know, I actually spent quite a bit of time in that area. Another world, I worked for a market research company and actually lived in an apartment in Mississauga. And so I know
that's
that
Mississauga is where I was born. Like, I was born in Mississauga and lived there as a kid.
Well, I had
it's a beautiful place.
I had a little flat near the Four Square Mall in Mississauga, if you know where that is.
I know where that is. You know what's crazy is when I was in Mississauga last, I was there by myself, and I went and I sat down in a restaurant. And I started eating. It was like a Chili's or, you know, some TGI Friday type restaurant. I sit down, and the waitress comes up, and she's like, are you eating alone? And I was like, yep. And she was like, do you want company? And I was like, sure. And she was like, okay, I'm off now, so I'm going to come sit with you. And then she just sat with me, and we had dinner together, and it was super, super nice. And I was like, I felt like the luckiest dude. I don't know where that's ever happened, but Mississauga is very, very, very nice bunch of people.
Spontaneous dating in Mississauga.
Yes, that's basically what was happening. So, very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
So one of the things that I always have enjoyed about Canada and spending a lot of time up there, I know you say it's boring, and for somebody from South Texas, you know, that's a very exotic destination. But the sports fans in Canada, I would dare say, are more more passionate about their sports than just about anywhere in the world. Or did you grow up a big sports fan?
Not really, like not completely. Like, there was, you know, like I'm Jewish. So like Jews up in Canada, very nervous of letting their kids, play hockey. You know, there's a lot of, I'd watch hockey, you know, but playing it, not so much. Same thing with, like, I think I played basketball for, like, a little while until my family, like watched, and then everyone was like, this is very nerve-wracking to watch. I'm very worried something's going to happen to you. You're going to get hit. Someone's going to – a tall kid's going to – I was very short. I was literally, like, 4 feet tall and 5 feet wide all the way up until I was, like, in ninth grade. So I kind of totally missed out on the possibility of being like good at sports. And if you're not good at sports, it's hard to get into them. You know, it's kind of, it can be a little more, tricky, but I am a huge, basketball fan now. And know a lot of basketball players, and it's a little more fun now to kind of, you know, watch people you know play.
Yeah.
I watch football whenever I can, and have had some good football barbecue days at my place and at friends' places and stuff, but yeah, growing up, it wasn't like everyone was very nervous that I was going to get hurt. So there was very little like positive reinforcement to keep playing, soccer or baseball. And it is like, it'd be like, I'd go to play, you know, baseball, and it'd be like, he's going to get some, the ball's going to hit him in the face and he's going to forget his name. It's very dangerous for him to be doing things like, let him play baseball on the video game system, you know?
So. Yeah, and it doesn't sound like London, Ontario, Canada is a large Jewish enclave in that area.
Yeah, not really. No, it went from, like, my whole family is from Montreal, Canada, which is, like, a very Jewish place. They have, like, a whole neighborhood that's like a Jewish neighborhood. And then in Montreal, like, Montreal was divided up between like the French and the Jews. That was it. There was like nobody else back in, you know, when I was born. So, I spent some time in Montreal and some time in London, Ontario. And then, for the most part, grew up in San Diego, which was like a weird sports town because, and I noticed this as a kid, like everyone would get super excited about the Chargers. Like if the Chargers were playing, people would paint their minivans with these lightning bolts. Everyone couldn't be more excited, and the Chargers would lose, and everyone would quickly wash their windows wash the light, they will peel the stickers off, and back to like pretending like they didn't care about anything. And I'll never forget that. It's not like like there are places like like Michigan or Texas, you know, if you're a Mavericks fan, you're a Mavericks fan year round. If you're a Laker fan, you're a Laker fan year. It doesn't matter if they're doing well, if they're not doing well, you love them. And San Diego's not like that. They're too busy surfing and smoking weed to like care about whether somebody is, you know, like if the team's not doing well, nobody cares. Yeah. They just did, you know. You could be in a restaurant, and everyone in the restaurant is a Charger or is a Padre, you know, one of the Padres, and you would never know. Nobody cares down there.
That's really interesting, because when did you make that move? I mean, that has to be a bit of a culture shock to go from Ontario to Southern California.
Yeah, I mean, I was young. I was like six, you know, I was a child.
Oh.
But it was a big change because, you know, like everyone back in, you know, and I just even noticed it, like everyone in Canada kind of looked like me, you know, or like they looked like my family. And then I got out to San Diego and it was just like girls with like, you know, like hot little blonde ladies and blonde girls and blonde. Everybody was blonde and, you know, had their hair done, and all the boys had like Reebok pumps. You remember the Reebok pump?
Absolutely.
The sneaker. Everyone had the Reebok pumps. Like when I was in Canada, I had heard of the Reebok pump the way that you hear about, like, you know, the legend of the Reebok. I was like, it's the thing that the Michael Jordan must be wearing. Like, I didn't think it's some, you know, I didn't think it's something you see in real life. And then everybody, you know, in Canada, it was like one of the neighborhood kids had the Nintendo, you know, and then everyone would go to his house and we'd all play the Nintendo together. It wasn't that like every person had their own Nintendo and boxes of games and stuff. It was very different, you know. Different world.
Yeah, I remember actually owning a pair of those, and I, you know, as I look back on it, you and I are roughly the same age. I'm a little bit older than you, but yeah. I did have a pair of those. And now, as I think about it, it was like a blood pressure cuff for your foot. When you would pump that thing up, it would get so tight, there was this, you know, people would thought, okay, this feels better, this feels good, and it's just cutting off the circulation to your feet. And
yeah, it's crazy. No, it's crazy. You know, I have 10 pairs of those right now. As a grown man, I have invested in buying a bunch of pairs. I have for me to wear around, and they are super crazy. They're like, it doesn't make any sense. But it's like every time I put on a pair, I'm like, I finally have my Reebok pumps. Who was that, America? So that's a thing.
Yeah. So when you moved to San Diego, looking from the outside in, the world of Hollywood and television, it seems like it is just unbelievably hard to get into, and just you hear all these stories about, you know, all the sacrifices and things. I've got a neighbor that has a child out there trying to make it in Hollywood right now. And so is this something that you from an early age knew that you wanted to do?
Well, you know, like I was one of those kids that like, very young. I remember like picking up my great grandmother's cane at like, I mean, we're talking like 6, 7 years old. I'd pick up like my great grandmother's cane and be like, "Yiddle, diddle, 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 diddle," you know, like put on a show. And everybody was very encouraging of that. Like they were very like, "Oh, look how silly and attention needy he is. Like he's hilarious. We should make him sing, during dinner." Like things like that. Like my family was very like, you know, My mom jokes about it with me, but it's 100% true. Instead of doing the dishes, she would, or like setting the table or cooking, she would have me play the piano. Like that was what I did instead of doing. So my sister would be setting the table or taking off the dishes or cleaning up or whatever, and I'd be sitting there playing, you know, songs on the piano for my whole family. And that was kind of like, that was kind of like the intro to it, is that everybody, you know, I kind of saw, I also like, I did magic when I was a kid, and I'd put on magic shows for everybody. And I've noticed among comedians, if you ask comedians, like kind of how they started, a lot of them started by putting on magic shows for their family, because it's like, you know, it's the first form. It's one of the first forms of like being a performer. It was like, you know, you go to the magic shop, you pick out some things, and then you perform it like a schmuck in front of everybody, and everybody laughs, and it's like a whole thing.
Yeah, I read an article, or maybe saw an interview with Penn Jillette, and there was a hierarchy of entertainment. And he basically echoed exactly what you just said, that the magician is the gateway to the world of entertainment.
Yeah, it really, really is. It 100% is. And then basically, like where the line got crossed, where it went from like I want to be in a, like I was doing some plays, you know, like all my friends, you know, in the chorus of some, you know, musical or some play at the local, you know, junior high school or whatever, you know, just as a kid, like as a little kid, like just getting thrown into a little community theater with all the other kids that were awkward and couldn't play sports. And my grandmother's brother was an insurance salesman in Los Angeles, and he was asked to insure Fred Astaire's legs after there was some incident that happened where somebody had been hurt. And so Fred Astaire asked my grandmother's brother to insure his legs for $1 million.
Wow.
And it was the first time anybody had ever done anything like that. And so he did, like he insured his legs for $1 million. And then Liberace was like, I want to insure my hands for $1 million. So then he insured Liberace's hands, and then someone else's voice, and then someone else's this. And then Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek, had asked to have his brain insured for $1 million. And so this uncle, this great uncle, whatever, had done this. And so my grandmother had this tie to the business, and my mom had like been around it a little bit. She'd seen, you know, had a little bit of interaction with it because of this great uncle. And so when like for my birthday one year, they took me on a tour of Paramount Studios, and I was like, I'm not kidding, I was maybe 8 years old, and they were Family Ties was being shot, and Step by Step. Day by Day. This is a totally different show. Day by Day. It was Courtney Thorne Smith and Juliet Louis-Dreyfus.
Oh, wow,
and
yeah.
A bunch of super random show. And, you know, Family Ties was Michael J. Fox and, right. You know, Tina Yothers.
Right.
And they were shooting the movie Willow on the Paramount
lot. That's Tom Cruise.
So,
yeah.
Like, and Beverly Hills Cop 2 was being shot on the lot. It was like the craziest thing ever. So I got a tour of the lot during that age at like 8, and my brain was just shattered by it. I came home, I was like, that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I'm going to work. I'm going to be on TV. I'm going to be on Family Ties. And I told everybody, I was like, I'm going to be on Family Ties. And like, everyone was like, okay. And I went to school, and I was like, I'm going to be on Family Ties. I've been cast on Family. I'm going to be on Family Ties. I, like, completely believed every inch of me was like, that's what's going to happen to me for the rest of my life. And the craziest part of that story is, when I got cast on Big Time Rush on Nickelodeon, we shot on the stage next to the stage where they shot Family Ties.
Wow.
At Paramount Pictures. And I worked at Paramount for 5.5 years, and it was like, I mean, it was every day, you know, you're just living out your childhood dream, which is the craziest thing ever.
Self-fulfilling prophecy there. That's a great story. I mean, that's awesome that you were able to visualize that. And I've always heard that, you know, if you really believe something to your core, you know, and I think there was a book out or a you know, called the Secret. Do you remember that talks about self actualization and all that? So that's fantastic. Yeah. But when you made the switch, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, when you made the switch in your mind that's what you were gonna do, how did that change your preparation as far as, I mean, I know you said you told all your friends you're going to be on Family Ties, but then there comes this time where there's got to be agents and there's got to be auditions and there has to be that process. Did you immediately start moving in that direction after you had made that decision?
You know, it became like this, it was this really weird thing. Like, I started doing is not as much like trying to find an agent, trying to find all that stuff. What I started doing was trying to focus on being a talented actor and working on all the aspects of what an actor would be and what, you know, like all those pieces of the puzzle and getting really good and kind of using my world down there to prep me for the world up here. So what I would do is, like, if let's say I was doing a play and they offered me the part of the dad in the play, you know, I'm like 13 years old, right? And they're like, hey, you want to play the dad in the play? Or there's a really small part, but it's like the homeless, elderly, you know, creepy guy. I'd be like, homeless, elderly, creepy guy. I will take that part because that is going to be, you know, it's going to take more work. I'm going to have to create a real character and build something, and I'm going to have to wear costumes, and I'm going to have to, you know, change my voice and do all sorts of weird stuff to make it work. And that became the process of, like, you know, and then writing stuff, like, you know, like, I would write stuff, I'd shoot stuff with our home video camera, but, like, I didn't know how to get an agent. I always kind of figured that, like, you don't get an agent, like, an agent finds you, and so if you try desperately to send out a million headshots to agencies, like, no one's going to, like, why would anybody want that? Like, right. It just doesn't make any sense. So you're just putting yourself in the pile with a bunch of other people. I always kind of felt like it'd be better to just do the best, do it yourself, find a way, and then, you know, at some point somebody will like you enough and be like, hey, you should come work with me, I guess. I don't know. It's kind of a weird,
How did your break with getting the role of Gustavo on Big Time Rush happen? Was that pretty organic, or was it a very traditional type process that got you that gig?
Well, what I have found, and this is kind of how that job came down, is sorry, my dog was jumping up on me. You want to ask me again?
No, that's fine. We'll roll with it. We've had dogs, we've had horses, we've had all kinds of weird stuff on this show, so no worries, man.
Okay, all right. Well, basically, here's how this went down. My manager said, I had a manager, and I have a wonderful manager now, And my manager now manages Jeff Ross and Sarah Silverman and Jay Baruchel and Michael Cera and lots of wonderful people. And I'm very lucky to be with her. She's an awesome, awesome manager and really believes in me and, you know, all, for like, across the spectrum, you know, listens to my ideas and, you know, very, very supportive. But that came very organically. It wasn't like me submitting to like a bunch of people and then ending up with somebody. It was like a friend, you know, who cared about my career and, you know, and wanted to be there. But with Big Time Rush, I went to a general meeting, which is how most of the work I've ever gotten happens, is I'll go into a general meeting where you just sit across from like a network executive and you just talk to them about who you are and you make them laugh and you have a good time. And then after, like, after the meeting's over, they're like, hey, you know what? We have a couple shows that we're doing that might be right for you. Why don't you go in for these shows? And that's how Big Time Rush happened. Is I went in, met with Nickelodeon. They were, you know, and during the meeting, she was like, you're going to be with this network for the rest of your life. And I was like, well, okay, I don't know. Well, doing what? But thank you for that. And she was like, don't worry about it. We'll see you soon. I have something, I think, for you for tomorrow. And so the next day, I go to this audition the next day. And I thought it was a voiceover audition. So I showed up in jeans, a t-shirt, and like a hoodie sweatshirt that was like a gangster hoodie sweatshirt with like weird symbols all over it. Like, and I walk in and every single guy at the audition is in a suit and tie. They have gray hair. They're all like businessmen. And I was like, what the hell? Why am I, this is completely the wrong, you're like, I'm at the wrong thing. And they're like, no, no, it's a live action TV show. And it's for the role of the executive at the record agency. And I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, I'm screwed. Like, I am not like a 50-year-old Silver Fox record executive. That was the role. And I was like, oh, great. I have no right to be here. This is ridiculous. I have to get out of here. I'm going to go yell at somebody because this is the worst thing ever. And they were like, you got to go in. Like, you can't just leave. You have to go. They want you to come in. And so I just decided to like kind of make it more about how big my ego was and play it as like a hip hop record producer.
Yeah.
So I went in and I was like, yo, what's up? I'm Gustavo and I'm about to tear this place apart. You don't know who I know Ice Cube. Okay. And I knew him when his name was Ice Trey. He was a terrible name, you know, and I just made up a whole bunch of crazy stuff. And I think I said something like, I gave Fred Savage his first rap album, The Savage, okay? I gave him his first damn, and he was, his Wonder Year brain was exploding with music, you know? And I was just saying all sorts of weird stuff, and they were like, this guy is crazy. And they called me back for like a callback 30 minutes after my audition. And I went to the callback 30 minutes after the audition. I had to, like, turn around, walk back in, and they were like, can you do these lines? Here are the lines. Do these lines. Don't make up anything. And I did the lines, and they were like, they were laughing the whole time. And they cast me. That was Thursday. They cast me Friday, and Monday we started shooting the show.
Wow.
And over the weekend, they rewrote the entire script so that the character sounded like me and didn't sound like this business guy anymore. It was now like this, you know, super crazy, like, you know, hip hop guy person with a big, crazy, yelling ego person thing. And then I helped. Like, I helped in the first episode to really, you know, tone the character and make him, you know, super crazy. And I kind of learned, you know, from like, growing up that, you know, and from acting experience and stuff, to go and meet with some record producers and just learn what it's like to actually be a famous record producer. And I got to meet with like the heads of Sony and watch them during their day. And then I just used that in the character to kind of make it more real. And it really paid off because it made, you know, it made it, you know, just way more fun to play.
How does it feel differently going from a situation where you're looking for that next role, that next job, to actually being in a situation where you've got, and I don't know if you do, but it seems to have a comfort level where you know where you're going to work every day, and you got to do that for, what, 5.5, 6 years? How does that play with your mind as far as your mindset in growing your craft and being more creative, knowing that you've got a home for a while?
You know, like, it really starts out, great. You really have to, like, keep working on yourself and on your character and on your stuff so that you don't get lazy, because you watch people all the time, like, you know, 5 seasons into a television show, and you're like, it's boring. You know, they're playing the same thing. They're not changing at all. Then the character's not growing, and the character, you know, or the character starts getting stale, the jokes start getting stale. But, like, I was really, really lucky. The writers on Big Time Rush were insanely talented writers, and they kept the character alive the whole time and funny and kept putting me in weirder and funnier situations. And like, as an actor, it was a fantastic experience. As a person, it was very interesting, because it changed everything about my life, you know, like, instantly. Like, the first season of the show, we shot almost the whole first season without anybody watching the show, because that's what happens, you know, you shoot, and then it comes out. And so we shot almost the whole first season just screwing around, not knowing if anybody was ever going to like it. And then it comes out, and the rating on the first episode was around the same numbers that, like, the Super Bowl gets. It was a 14.9 in the rating system, which is, like, to give you an idea, like, The Daily Show does, like, a 2.3.
Wow.
So, it was crazy. It was, like, 9-10 million people were watching the show every week, and it was, like, anywhere I'd go, people would be freaking out. And, like, that was just me. Like, I'm just the grown-up on the show. Like, the kids on the show, they couldn't go anywhere. They were getting mobbed at, like, malls and at places. Like, it was crazy. Like, it was, for that first season was crazy. Second season, like, you start, you know, you go to work and you're like, you're making more money than you've ever made in your life. I have no skills when it comes to, like, money management and things like that. Like, I wasn't good at math, you know? So I'm just, like, I have, like, a cool little apartment, you know, condo that I'm living in with a friend, a roommate, and we're, like, buddies and going out for dinner every night, and, you know, dating, you know, I'm dating these crazy girls and flying girls into town to date them and doing whatever I want, just, like, you know, living this super crazy life, paying, like, a publicist, which is so expensive, and, like, just doing stupid, you know, just because you don't know everybody else in your cast. They all start doing stuff, you know, like, they all are like, hey, we have to become corporations. We have to become corporations. It saves us so much money. And you're like, it does? You're like, yeah. Okay, well, I guess we should do that. And then you're like, oh, I've made a terrible, terrible choice with my life. Like, you do these crazy things. But the one thing that kept me grounded the whole time, and thank God for it, is I was doing stand-up. I've been doing stand-up for 12, 13 years. And I did stand-up the whole time I was on the show. And stand-up is like the great equalizer where you go up on stage. It doesn't matter if, I mean, you know, the adults in the audience, they didn't care that I was on the Nickelodeon show. So you go up, and if you didn't do well, that's just, you know.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about, so talk about that transition between a show that is taped and is in a very controlled environment versus the Wild West that is stand-up comedy. I'm a huge fan of stand-up comedy and try to get out and spend time in New York at the Comedy Cellar, just hanging out there with my wife, and we'll spend 2 or 3 days there at a time. And when acts come into town, we always enjoy that. But, I mean, that has got to be, from a performer's perspective, I mean, that's the ultimate sign of either fearlessness or insanity, because you don't know what kind of reaction you're going to get from night to night. The same joke that kills on one night could be that, you know, that cricket chirping in the background the next night. And you know, so how do you reconcile that in your mind? Because for me, that is I can't wrap my head around that at all.
Well, you know what it's like? It's like, I've been, you know, like, once you do stand up long enough, you start to build your A material into your act, where you're like, no matter what, these jokes, these 5 jokes are always going to kill no matter what happens. These are just solid kills. And what happens is if you do one of those jokes that you know kills every single time, and it dies, your brain immediately goes, okay, well, one of 2 things are happening. And this is happening while you're still talking in front of a room of people. One of 2 things are happening. Either A, this audience sucks, or B, you're not doing a good job with your own stuff. So you're either bored with your material or something is off. But it is usually what happens is if I'm doing a show and I try one of those solid gold things that have, you know, the stuff that you would do on late night television, like stuff that is, you know, clean and it crushes every single time. You tell that and it doesn't work, then you just, your brain just kind of goes, well, it's that night tonight. It's the night where I suck. And then you kind of enjoy it, and you remember that there are comics sitting in the back of the room, and they know that you know that it's not working because they know your stuff and you know their stuff. And what I always do is I'll call out to them and be like, well, Matt, it's today is the day where I shoot myself in the face during the show, I guess, plan, you know, and he'll laugh or he'll yell up to me, do the thing about the girl, the, you know, that from Louisiana, do the Louisiana joke. And you're like, all right. And then, you know, I'll go in. What I'm lucky about with stand-up is that I'd say out of all my material, 85% of my material is true stories that actually happened in my life that are real things that are, and then there's like a little bit of like embellishment to make it a little bit funnier. But I mean, that way, when I go up on stage, I'm like, what stories do I want to tell tonight? Oh, I guess I'll tell the one about the bird, and I'll tell the one about, you know, the family dog, and I'll tell the one about going into a sex shop, or I'll tell this one, and I'll just have like a list of like a bunch of stories, and then I just tell the stories. And if they don't, you know, if they don't land perfectly, then I'm happy, because I mean, if they land perfectly, then, you know, I'm happy. But if they don't land perfectly, like, it doesn't matter. It's just, you know, it's just a show. You know, there's always another one, and they're live, so the pressure is way less than something like television.
Really?
Because with television, you've got like, you know, 50 people standing around one camera pointing at your face, and you have to like say the line the way they want the line, and if you don't say it the way they want it, they can't move on. They can't have lunch. They can't go home to their kids. You know.
Yeah. Like, so the immediate feedback you get from the live audience doesn't bother you near as much as the fact that you've got this machine that's got to put this product out, and they're relying on you to do it the right way. Am I understanding that?
Completely. Yeah. Totally. I mean, shooting television is one of the most, you know, one of the funnest, craziest things in the world, because you're making something, you have no idea what it's going to look like. You have no idea what it's, you know, how they're going to cut it together, or how it's going to work. And then, you know, 6 months later, you turn on your TV and, you know, you're like, oh my God, there's that thing. You forget. You complete. And after I'd shoot a week of Big Time Rush, I'd forget what the episode was. Like the following week, you could say to me, hey, what was the episode from last week you guys shot where the thing? I have no idea. Unless there was some celebrity guest star or whatever, it was just another episode about something else. And then I'd watch it on TV and be like, oh my God, I got hit in the face with 60 cream pies. Look at that. I totally forgot that I did that. But your short-term memory is working so fast to like memorize lines and to, you know, to be in the moment and be on top of it, that when it's done, it just leaves your mind and you have to let it go and you have to start the next thing.
It's memory dump and move on, right?
Yeah, completely. And with stand-up, like, sometimes I record all my sets on my phone, like audio. And, you know, 2-3 days later, I'll listen to the set and I'll be like, oh my God, like, I did a callback to a joke from the beginning of a set at this other, you know, 10 minutes in, and it killed. Like, man, I got to remember to do that more often. Like, I totally forgot that I did that. It just, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing that you, you know, I was going to ask you about this because before I ask that, I want to ask, who were some of your comedy influences growing up? Who did you follow?
Oh, George Carlin, for sure. Eddie Murphy. When my dad left when I was like 13, like 14 years old, my mom, to cheer me up, started taking me to comedy clubs, and they would let me sit in the back and like watch comedians perform at like La Jolla Comedy Store and the old Improvisation down in La Jolla. And there's a comedy club in Oceanside that's been gone for a long time, but I would go there, and then she'd buy me stand-up CDs, and I'd listen to them, like, every single day. And it was Eddie Murphy, Delirious.
Yep.
It was George Carlin, Live from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
It was Dennis Leary, No Cure for Cancer, and Pauly Shore's first album. And that was it. Like, it was those albums, and I listened to them on repeat, and I memorized all the jokes, and it, you know, I tried to learn how to do their voices, you know, like,
yeah.
I was just obsessed with those guys.
What a cool mom you had, too, taking you to comedy clubs.
She's awesome.
That is fantastic.
She is awesome.
That's great. Well, I want to transition real quickly into, we're here with Stephen Kramer Glickman. He is you're a Renaissance man. You've done live, like Broadway. Didn't you play Shrek or worked on that production of Shrek?
Yeah, I mean, like that's a weird one too, man. Like, I got cast to play Shrek in Shrek the Musical on Broadway. I did all the Broadway readings of it and the Broadway workshops. Like, I worked with like Jeffrey Katzenberg and David Geffen from mm-hmm. DreamWorks, and Sam Mendes, the director, and Jason Moore, the director of Pitch Perfect and all that stuff. He did he directed Shrek and Avenue Q and all these other musicals. And I got cast in that out of an open call. And it was this comedian, Eric Marino, from the Comedy Store. He was like, hey, you should go audition for that Shrek thing. I was like, you should go screw yourself. I was like, I'm a comedian, man. I stopped doing theater, you know. I went to school for theater, and, like, I did theater my whole life. But, like, you know, I was like, I'm in L.A. now. I don't need to be doing theater. And he was like, dude, you should go. They are looking for Shrek. And I told my family, and my sister was like, you have to go. You have to go do this. And I went to an open call and beat out, like, 30,000 other guys for the role of Shrek in the Shrek musical. And they moved me to New York. And all my friends were like, what just happened? All the other comics at the Comedy Store were like, you're going to New York to be in a Broadway show? I was like, yep, bye. And, left, went out to New York, and they moved me out there. And I got really lucky. The guy playing the donkey in Shrek, I was playing Shrek. So the guy playing the donkey was Dean Edwards, who is on Saturday Night Live. And he is an amazing stand-up comedian and a great impressionist. And he was like, let me take you around to all the comedy clubs and get you passed at all the clubs so you can play out here. And I was like, oh, I love him so much. He's the freaking best dude ever. And he, like, introduced me to everybody, and I got to become a paid regular at, like, Caroline's and Stand-Up New York and, you know, Comic Strip Live and Gotham and all these wonderful places, and got to start, you know, doing stand-up out there, and then also work on this Shrek musical. And they'd be doing, like, makeup tests on me and trying to turn me into this giant monster, and, like, shoe tests and giant set piece tests and all sorts of crazy stuff. Like, it was crazy. The budget for a regular Broadway musical is approximately $11 million to $20 million. Most expensive Broadway musical at the time, $20 million, which was the producers, Mel Brooks's.
Right.
Right. So the best. One of the best musicals of all time. You know, one of the best movies of all time. Great show. And our budget for Shrek the musical was $45 million. Yeah.
Wow.
That's a lot of money. And for that world out there, there's a lot of money.
No pressure there.
It's a lot of money for anything, but right. That is a lot of money for a Broadway musical. And they were doing all sorts of crazy stuff. We had a set piece that was this staircase that was on hydraulics. And you'd have to run up the stairs, and when you got to the top, the hydraulics would kick in, and the stairs would collapse, and they would like be like a seesaw, and it would become a downward staircase, and you'd have to hold on to the railings and adjust your footing, and it would turn into a downward staircase, and you have to run down the other side of the staircase. If that makes sense. And the staircase was on wheels, so it was being spun in circles, and you're running up it, and then the hydraulics kick in, boom, and it starts to turn into a downward staircase going the other way, and then you have to run down the stairs. And about the third time I was on it, it was me and the donkey and the Fiona character were up on the top of this. The hydraulics snapped in half, and we all fall off of a 20-foot.
Whoa.
Like 20 stairs up, just boom, to the ground, and we're all landing on top of each other, and everyone was just a mess. And it was like that. It was like that for like almost 2 years of working on that musical, where you'd come in, you try out a song that they wrote, and then they throw it in the garbage, and they go, nope, sorry, not going to work. Write another one, guys. And it was a really incredible experience. But right before the show opened, they basically They fired me and the donkey and one other character and replaced us with, like, super famous Broadway stars that they had been kind of hiding in the wings and not telling us that we would be replaced at the last moment, which was, you know, of course, infuriating. But they paid us a ton of money, and we got royalties on the show for 20 years. So anytime there's a performance of the show anywhere in the world, we get paid a very handsome royalty for it. So, and if I would have stayed in the show, I would never have been cast on Big Time Rush, because I came out to L.A. literally like a month, you know. I was out for like, I was here for like a month when I got cast on Big Time Rush. So it was crazy.
Timing is everything, crazy, right? World. Timing is everything. Wow. I'm here with,
it really is, man.
I'm here with Stephen Kramer Glickman. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is I've spent a lot of time on your YouTube channel, and it's Funny Guy from TV. And, talk to me about
Funny Guy from TV.
Yeah. Yes. Funny Guy from TV. And I have watched, in fact, my kids, when they heard I was going to be interviewing you, I've had to make sure they were nowhere in sight. They wanted to ask you a bunch of questions about Big Time Rush, and I had to, you know.
Oh, you totally do that. I will totally take questions from your kids. Are you kidding me?
But one of the other cool things is the YouTube channel and social media in general. How has that direct portal to the world with your own material, your own creations from collaborations with other folks, how has that opened up doors, or what has that done for your career and your ability to experiment and do some really cool things that you may not be able to do with without the backing of a studio or something like that?
Oh, dude, it's outrageous, man. Like, I love YouTube, and I love, like, being able to make cool stuff and weird, you know, short films and, you know, sketches and parodies and, you know, commercials and whatever, and be able to just cut, like, I cut it myself in Final Cut Pro, and I usually shoot it with my friends, and I'll cut it, you know, or I'll rip it down from the internet and recut stuff and revoice over things. I think you may have seen on there, I took a bunch of commercials and recut them as
right
with Tracy Morgan as the voiceover for them. And they're hilarious and they're so weird. And I love that kind of stuff. Like, I love being able to just have stuff to play around with. But where it's really changed my life is I've been making, you know, like I've produced a couple movies and you know, directed some web series and things like that, and I got really lucky. I wrote a script for Beggin' Strips, and because my dog loves Beggin' Strips, so I was like, I'm gonna write a little sketch, and I wrote it and I shot it and gave it to Beggin' Strips. So I was like, look, I made something for you guys. And they were like, do you want to work together? And I was like, yeah, I do. And they were like, how about we sign you to a 2-year contract and you will be like a celebrity ambassador for our company, and you can make more videos like this, and we'll fund them, and we'll pay for them. And I did, and I am lucky enough to say that yesterday, one of those videos just landed on target.com/Purina, a commercial that I produced and wrote and directed. Just landed on there, and it looks awesome, and it's really fun. And you know, like, I just landed a contract to do the same kind of work but with Craftsman Tools, which is like the coolest thing in the world for
Absolutely.
Me, because I'm a huge, like, DIY guy. I'm constantly building stuff at home and making, you know, crazy stuff. And, you know, my mom was like, she's like a huge woodworking person, is always building things and making things. And so she taught me, you know, kind of how to do a lot of that. And, getting to work with a company like Craftsman, you know, Sears and stuff.
It's heck just yeah.
Outrageous.
Like, yeah. And we have a
huge, it's huge.
We have a gadget segment on this show, and man, we would love for you to come back and do a gadget segment, something from Craftsman. That would be awesome. Oh. That would be awesome.
He's got this. They have this thing. They have this bolt-on tool thing that where it's like you can just in like seconds like pop off. One tool and. You know, slap on another one, and they just interchange. And I just used it for a project to build this cabinet for my new place, and it looks awesome, and it worked great. So yeah, I'd love to to talk with you guys about stuff like that anytime. But yeah, YouTube, you know, it really has given me it's given people and everyone a voice to. To kind of, show how they see the world and how they like to make stuff. And, it's wonderful. And, and Twitter and stuff like that, Twitter is the craziest invention. It's way better than Facebook or any of this other stuff. It's it's the most bizarre thing in the whole world because companies that's how you and me got in touch.
Absolutely. Twitter, absolutely.
That's insane. The other night I saw this thing. I was going through all my stuff and I had bought these war ration books in an antique shop in Michigan. And so I took a picture of them and I posted them and I tagged the state of Michigan and the Michigan Library and Ancestry.com and all these other places. And I was like, can anyone help me return these war ration books to the family that, that they're from? I have no idea how to get these to whatever the family is, but can you guys help me do it, internet? And it did an insane amount of retweets and favorites, and people have been following me that are genealogy people, one after another, just kind of going I think it's great what you're trying to do to reunite people with their stuff from their past. And I was okay, cool. I'm unpacking my boxes in my new place and I'm like, hey, we should give these to the right people. But I love that you can do stuff like that on the internet.
Yeah, and going back to Twitter, I had an experience with a phone company. I won't mention which phone company it is, but I had gone through the channels of customer service, and they just gave me just a big-ass runaround. It was just ridiculous. And so I got on our little Twitter account and just expressed my frustration with this particular company, and within 15 minutes – someone from that organization had sent me a tweet and said, whatever it is you need, we're going to fix it for you. And they did. I mean, it was amazing. And I would have not gotten that kind of help because I had been, on hold with their customer service for an hour and a half and gotten nowhere.
Oh, yeah.
But the power of the social media is a really it's a really powerful thing. And in your case with the genealogy stuff, I mean – it's amazing how that web intertwines with so many different people and so many different countries and cultures and things like that.
Oh yeah. Oh no, I love it. There are times where you can just kind of go when I was a kid, my favorite TV show is the show called Parker Lewis Can't Lose. And it was this terrible, stupid show about three guys that were best friends. And I grew up thinking maybe someday I'm going to be best friends with the main actor on that show. And it was some random TV show, some after school TV show from when I was
Yeah, I remember it. It was, wasn't it kind of a knockoff of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, kind of?
It was.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And the main actor on it, he followed me on Twitter. I said something about it, and then he followed me on Twitter. And we started talking on Twitter and became friendly. And now we've talked, numerous times, but it's like, now, like, but he's like, yeah, no, my, I know who you are. Like, I watch, I've watched the show and the kids show, and my family watches it, and I've got nieces and nephews and stuff, and they've seen it. And I was like, my inner kid brain was just kind of losing it. My favorite one, and this is the dude. This is like how crazy life can get. So I'm watching, I'm in a hotel room, doing stand up, down in San Diego, and, I'm at the Hard Rock Hotel, and I'm watching, TV, and I see this show called Toy Hunter, and it was, the show with, this guy, and he travels all over the world looking for like the coolest, most expensive toys in the world. And I was like hooked immediately. I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. This guy, Jordan Hembrough, is the host. And I'm watching, and I'm just dying. I'm like, this is so crazy. Like a He-Man toy that no one's ever seen before. And, it was like they only made 10 of them. And I'm like, I'm like hooked to the show. And I went out, and I bought every season of the show and just watched every single episode, like one at a time. And I got like super into it. So I started tweeting about it. I'm like, everyone's got to watch this show. If you haven't watched it, whatever, whatever. Guy reaches out to me, Jordan Hembra, the toy hunter from this show, reaches out to me. He's like, hey, thanks for promoting my show. It's about to air in England. Do you mind saying that people should watch it in England? I'm like, hell yeah. No big deal. Hey, everybody, watch the show in England. Tweet, right? It does. The tweet goes out. The show airs the following week, and the numbers go up. And he goes, hey, like the numbers of how many people are watching.
Right.
So he writes back and he goes, hey, the numbers went up last week from our last week in England. Would you mind tweeting again? And I was like, not only will I do that, I will ask a bunch of my other friends to tweet. And I got like four or five other celebrity people to tweet about it. Chris Daughtry, a bunch of other people. We all tweet about it at the same time. The numbers went up 40% in the rating.
Wow.
That week.
That's amazing.
Like, crazy. So he comes back and he's like, what is your favorite toy when you grew up? What was your favorite toy? And I was like, I loved the Superpowers collection, the Marvels, the DC Superpowers collection. It was like all the superheroes. He was like, okay, no problem. What's your address? I gave him my address. I get a package in the mail, all sealed toys from 1982. Batman,
nice.
And, Lex Luthor's plane, and all this crazy stuff, and I'm losing my mind, right? So I'm like, dude, look, I'm doing an event for Children's Hospital for my birthday. It was on March 17th. I had a birthday party, and for my birthday, I did a celebrity toy drive. And I teamed up with Duff Goldman, the guy from Ace of Cakes, who hosts that show. So I teamed up with him and with Children's Hospital with Loot Crate, this very cool company that does like these boxes full of like nerdy cool stuff. And I was like, can we do an event, all of us together? Everyone said yes. Super fun event. We had kids from Children's Hospital there. We had the Batmobile, the original Batmobile was parked, and Stan Lee, his whole team came out and donated all sorts of signed Stan Lee stuff, and Chris Daughtry flew in and signed two guitars, and we put them up for auction, and Jordan Hembrough, the toy hunter guy, flew in from Jersey just for the party to help... to like help me with the party and help do the silent auction, and because he knows prices so well of what things are worth, he did our silent auction, and we raised a ton of money and a ton of toys for Children's Hospital. It was awesome. But all of that, like all of that, that whole relationship because of Twitter and, you know, fun conversations between, you know, people and stuff. I just love that kind of stuff.
And people can find you on Twitter at Stephen, that's with a P-H, Glickman, right? At Stephen Glickman?
Yeah, it's just S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Glickman, G-L-I-C-K-M-A-N, just at Stephen Glickman on Twitter. And you can ask me anything, anytime. I do, you know, follows. I follow people all the time, and I tweet all sorts of weird stuff, and I'm always posting, like, contests for things and, you know, always trying to make it a fun place to be.
And people can find you also on YouTube at your youtube.com/funnyguyfromTV. And I can tell you from personal experience, you're going to laugh your ass off when you go over there. There's just some great. I still see in my dreams, I see that squirrel flying out the window. That is one of the most awesome clips I have ever seen in my life. I just love that. And there's so much more of that kind of material on your YouTube site. Stephen, I want to thank you so much for coming in to Tailgate Radio. Yeah. And we'd love to have you back. And we have events in different locations throughout the year. And I know we'll be out in Los Angeles this fall and would love to connect with you out there.
Absolutely. And if I can say real quick, if you're in Southern California, come on out to the La Jolla Comedy Store for the July 4th weekend, where I will be performing stand-up comedy for the entire weekend with some other very, very funny people. And it's going to be a great time. So, and thanks so much for having me on the show, man.
Time is right to use a spud spike. Boil them spikes, make it fast and nice. Crispy on the outside, fluffy in the middle. Don't you just love the spud spike?
Spud spike's the original food grade stainless steel 6-inch baking potato perfection system. It's made right here in the USA. The spud spikes, along with our gourmet potato skin rubs and everyday seasonings, are perfect for baking, barbecuing, cookouts, grilling, steaming. They're good for indoor and outdoor kitchens, campers, RVs, tailgating, barbecue lovers, brats, sausages, and perfect holiday gifts for that special loved one. Just a nail? I don't think so. The Spud Spikes Baked Potato Perfection System. Buy it online now at spudspikes.com. That's spudspikes.com.
It's right to use a Spud Spike. You oil and spice and make it fast and nice. It's Christmas.
And welcome back to the show. Again, I want to thank Stephen Kramer Glickman for that great interview. I certainly had a great time talking to him. And I want to just say this as a side note. After we completed that interview, you know, my kids were big fans of Big Time Rush on Nickelodeon. And he actually spent time on the phone talking to my kids and just asking them some questions about their favorite episodes and stuff like that. Just a really, really cool guy, and support anything he's doing out there. Just one of the really nicest guys we've spoken to as far as guests coming on the show and just being very generous with his time. So thanks again to Stephen Kramer Glickman for coming in this week on Tailgate Radio. Now it's time for that segment that you either love or hate, but here it is. It's the Sports Mouth of the South, Jason Fairchild, with this week's Big Time Breakdown.
It's time for the Big Time Breakdown. For the Big Time Breakdown. Big Time Breakdown.
To New England we go, the land of blank stares, pathetic excuses, and smug denials whenever NFL team rules are violated and broken. Ted Wells released his 243-page Deflategate report earlier this week. Are you freaking kidding me, Ted? 243 pages to tell us that, yes, the Patriots used deflated game balls, and yes, Tom Brady probably knew about it. Let me explain what probably knew about it means to all the Patriot fans listening and anyone with an IQ of, let's say below 25. If you go to bed and wake up with 3 feet of snow on the ground, You didn't actually see it snow because you were asleep, but you probably know that it did because you have two eyes and half a brain. Are you freaking kidding me? Tom Brady knew. Let's take a look at some of the details of the Wells report. Brady calls and texts John Jastrzemski, a.k.a. JJ, the equipment assistant, over six times the 3 days following the Deflategate game against the Colts. Why is this important? Because Brady had not contacted JJ by phone or text for the previous 6 months prior to that Sunday. Guys, Ray Charles could connect these dots. Tom was making sure that everyone was on the same page as the NFL had begun its initial investigation. Another interesting fact that's worth pointing out about JJ is he's had the same job with the Pats his entire adult life. He's 35 and worked for them for over 15 years. Want to know how to keep your first job? Hell, any job for 15 years? You show up to work every day, you keep your mouth shut, and most important of all, you do exactly what your bosses, aka the players and Hall of Fame quarterback, tell you to do. Are you freaking kidding me? Brady knew. Enter Jim McNally, the officials' locker room attendant. Jim's primary responsibility was presenting the game balls to the officials for inspection and then taking them to the field at the appropriate time once they were approved. Well, on this Sunday, Jim got it half right as far as the NFL was concerned. After getting the game balls approved, Jim then takes the footballs and disappears into a bathroom for almost 2 minutes and deflates them. Remember the snow analogy, Patriot fans? I don't have to see it, just have half a brain to know that it actually happened. Are you freaking kidding me? McNally appears fieldside shortly before kickoff and presents the officials with the deflated game balls. You need only ask yourself two questions when trying to solve this Deflategate mystery. Number one, do I believe the footballs were deflated by McNally in the bathroom prior to the game? And secondly, why would two minions in the Patriots organization, a.k.a. McNally and Jastrzemski, risk their jobs and careers unless they felt like they didn't have a choice? Being told by Tom Brady to adjust the air in the game balls to his liking isn't an option. It's an order if you work for the Patriots. If you still don't believe Deflategate happened, well, then you're an idiot. You need to take off those red and blue glasses, climb into your number 12-footed PJs, get under your Patriot sheets, and close your eyes as you drift off to sleep, staring at your Brady bobblehead. Once you get to Never Never Land or Oz, tell Peter Pan, Dorothy, and Toto, the sports mouth said, "What's up?" Are you freaking kidding me? I'm the sports mouth of the South, Jason Fairchild, and thanks for listening to the Big Time Breakdown on Tailgate Radio. We love to hear from our listeners. You can reach us on Twitter at BTB Sports Radio. That's at BTB Sports Radio. Until next week, big timers, this is the Sports Mouth, and I'm out.
All right, folks, that's going to about wrap it up for this week's episode of Tailgate Radio. I want to thank our very special guest this week, Mr. Stephen Kramer Glickman, for coming in. We certainly had a great time talking to him, and it's just nice to talk to such a grounded and just a really class guy all the way around. So we certainly appreciate him. Also, Jason Fairchild for coming in with his big time breakdown. We've got so much to talk about, folks. Before we go, again, don't forget to head to our website at tailgateradio.com for all the latest news, recipes, videos, and also over at our Twitter site at Tailgate Radio, at Tailgate Radio. And you can check out some of the links and retweets and some of the original content we send out there. You can also link directly to our Twitter to listen to the show every week on Stitcher Radio. You can also catch us, as always, at iTunes and the TuneIn app for your smartphone and Roku and Apple TV and Audio Boom over in Europe and down in Australia and New Zealand. So lots of different ways you can listen to the show, lots of different ways you can connect with Tailgate Radio. We continue that momentum through the fall, getting ready for the summer and all the summer activities that go along with that. So thank you once again for all your support. Thank you for supporting our sponsors. And we'll be back again next week with another great episode of Tailgate Radio. So as we always say here, and I say it every week, keep the drinks cold and the grill hot, and we'll see you in the parking lot. catch your asses on down the road.
Check 1, 2.
Game Day Media.